I'm Jim Juno, and this is Lights, Camera, Author. On September 16, 1922, the bodies of Reverend Edward Hall and Eleanor Mills were found beneath a crabapple tree on an abandoned farm outside of New Brunswick, New Jersey. The killer had arranged the bodies in a pose conveying intimacy. The murder of Hall, a prominent clergyman whose wife, Frances Hall, was a proud heiress with illustrious ancestors and ties to the Johnson & Johnson dynasty, would have made headlines all on its own. But when authorities identified Eleanor Mills as a choir singer from his church married to the church sexton, the story shocked locals and sent the scandal ricocheting around the country, fueling the tabloid newspaper industry. Vanity Fair's Joe Pompeo investigates the notorious 1922 double murder of a high society minister and his secret mistress, a jazz age megacrime that propelled tabloid news in the 20th century, in his new book, Blood and Ink. And I talked to Joe Pompeo about the book. Joe Pompeo, your new book is coming out called Blood and Ink, the scandalous jazz age double murder that hooked America on true crime. And this was a double murder which happened 100 years ago, actually this very week, wasn't it?
This very week. The murders themselves would have been September 14th, 1922. So that's Thursday. My head's sort of spinning right mm-hmm. now. But I think today's the 12th. Tomorrow's the 13th. So Wednesday. This Wednesday would be the 100th anniversary of the murders, but really the big date, as far as the historical record is concerned, would be September 16th, 1922, which is this Friday. And that's when the bodies were found. That's really when the story began in earnest.
Exactly. Yeah. But like you said, the bodies were found. Well, let's educate people for a few minutes. This is known as the Hall Mills murder case. If you Google it, you'll find some information on it. And basically, two people were murdered, and one in New Jersey, Somerset, New Jersey. And one was an Episcopalian minister. His name was Edward Wheeler Hall. And his body was found with the body of a married woman by the name of Eleanor Reinhardt Mills. And let me know if I'm getting anything wrong here so far.
No, it's all good, except we should know Edward. They're both married, but not to one another.
Right. Okay. I didn't realize he was married. Yeah, they were both married, not to one another. And their bodies were found in bed together, fully clothed. But I believe his hand was on her neck. And well, I'll let you tell it.
Yeah. So they were found in a field on an abandoned farm, right outside of New Brunswick, New Jersey, which is where all the characters in this story live. That's the home for your listeners. That's the home of Rutgers University. It's also where Johnson & Johnson is based. And they were found sort of on the outskirts of town, in right over the border in Somerset County, this sort of infamous lover's lane, but it was on an abandoned farm. And the corpses were posed in a way that strongly suggested that there was something going on between these two people. They were lying on their backs, the bodies next to one another. His right arm was outstretched, and her head was resting on it, as if they were sort of cuddling. Her mm-hmm. her left hand was placed upon his thigh. So very a pose conveying affection and intimacy, and also just a very careful arrangement. Their clothing was completely neat, and the whole scene was very carefully laid out, even though a pretty gruesome amount of violence had been committed on them, especially on Eleanor. So she had three bullet she was shot in the face three times, so three bullet holes in her face. Her neck was slit from ear to ear. An autopsy would later reveal that she'd nearly been decapitated. That's how deep the wound was. And as people began inspecting the bodies at the crime scene, they pulled down a scarf, and it was clear that this deep gash in her throat was filled with maggots. The bodies had been there at that point, about 36 hours or so. Yeah. He had one bullet in his face. He was just shot once, but he had a Panama hat was placed over his eyes. So, you know, placed to cover his face, you know, as if he was, you know, sleeping in the sun or something like that. The scarf had originally been pulled up over her face. So there was a fair amount of thought to how this whole scene was constructed after they were killed. There were a couple of other details that it became very important to the case. Between the bodies, there was a little pile of papers. These were love notes. They were love notes that she, Eleanor, had written to Edward. Of course, he wrote a lot of love letters to her as well. Those would later materialize, but the ones at the scene were all of hers to him. And also there was the Reverend's calling card, which bore his name, was placed near his foot, almost as if, you know, whoever found them, they would immediately know who he was. And indeed, the first reporter on the scene who picked up the card, you know, would have been able to immediately tell, this is a pretty big story. This is a scandalous story. This is a prominent local reverend married to this very rich woman from town. And the whole thing from there just took off.
It amazed me that even in 1922, I mean, there was procedures for murder cases. Of course, there was no DNA or anything like that. But the site, there was a competition or between who has jurisdiction?
Yeah, there were two different police forces that, you know, ended up at the scene early on. The first were two just beat cops from New Brunswick. The young people that found the bodies, you know, they came from New Brunswick. They were out there. We can imagine why they were out on, you know, on a lover's lane in the morning, but they made up this story saying that they were out searching for mushrooms, which was a kind of pathetic cover. But they ran to the nearest house, which was in New Brunswick. Again, this scene was kind of right on the county line between Middlesex County, where New Brunswick's located, and Somerset County, and that would have been the town of Franklin. And so these people go to a house, they call the New Brunswick police, that's who responds first. These officers, one of them says, you know, this is no case of ours, because he can tell that it appears that the bodies are over the county line. So then the Somerset County authorities are summoned and they sort of take the lead. But, you know, throughout the investigation in the early weeks, there's still kind of a question of, were these people killed here in Somerset County, or were they killed in New Brunswick and Middlesex County and brought here? So there is these two different sets of officials that were sort of, I don't know if competing is the right word, but there were, you know, because there's probably an element where, you know, one side wished that the other would just have to deal with it themselves, but it did create some, you know, some confusion and complications and some tensions in the investigation right off the bat.
And while all this is going on, the site's not secured.
Not secured. And even by, you know, as you point out, you know, even by 1922 standards, there would have been some level of knowing how to secure a crime scene. You know, this was still a time when, you know, forensic science, you know, crime forensics were in their infancy, especially in America compared to Europe. And especially in, you know, this wasn't like the New York City NYPD, which would have had a big city police force would have had a little bit more, smarter approach to things, but even just like the most basic things, you know, the scene wasn't secured immediately. Like gawkers and onlookers just started descending on this place. Reporters, people were picking up pieces of evidence, touching the love letters, you know, picking up the scarf. I mean, there was really nothing that the responding police did or could do. I mean, maybe they just couldn't keep these crowds back, but immediately people were just like trampling all over things. There were no photographs taken. There was, you know, I mentioned an autopsy. That was actually, you know, weeks later. The both bodies were buried without a proper autopsy. They got a cursory kind of look over from the coroner, who made some notes in a morgue report. But they did. They weren't properly examined. You know, they weren't actually, you know, really given a proper autopsy. That would happen later. So really everything that, that you could kind of do wrong to ensure that, you know, your crime scene is it's corrupted and that this is going to be a problem for you down the line happened.
Now, eventually there was a trial. I use the word eventually because it was like 4 years after the fact.
That's right.
And they had suspects. I mean, they had like his wife was one of the suspects. Her brothers, I believe, were other suspects. And
sort of a trio of suspects, we could say. Yeah. The widow and her two brothers.
And of course, I mean, I don't want to give away the book. I don't want to say what happens, but this became a national fascination with this trial and with this case. And I have to remind people, this is before the internet. This is before radio. This is before radio, I believe, too.
Yeah, radio is very in its infancy, but it really wasn't. As far as the media of the time, I think radio would probably become more of a force a few years later. Like I think in the Lindbergh case, radio, that was kind of maybe one of the first big cases where radio played a factor, but radio was coming on the scene, but it wasn't, you know, this was really still a newspaper crime. This was it was newspapers that really drove the coverage of this.
Right. And there was no newsreels either in the, in the Lindbergh case.
Yeah, there would have been some primitive ones like Hearst had a news service. There is some, you know, on Getty Images has some really rare early newsreel footage of outside the courtroom, but definitely not. That was would have been like a sliver of the coverage. This was people reading about this in newspapers all over the country day after day.
Especially in the New York newspapers.
Especially the New York newspapers. There were still a lot of them at that time, morning papers, evening papers, they're very competitive. The New York Times wrote more than any other paper on this. It was the big broadsheet and their articles would be very, very, very long. But also, you know, there was a new, you know, as I talk about in the book, this is a key part of my story, my telling of this story, I should say, was the 1920s. It was the birth of the American tabloid press. So this was a new form of newspaper that was particularly geared towards sensation and luridness, crime, divorce, scandal, sex, all that stuff. And also just like trivial obsessions, you know, the 1920s, this was a time after, you know, years of war, after the flu pandemic. And it was, people were just going wild and people loved to obsess over trivial things, whether that was, competitive sports and boxing and mahjong, whether that was, you know, this craze in aviation and transatlantic flight, movie stars. I mean, this was a time when, you know, really celebrity culture, like as we know it today, really came alive. And the tabloid newspapers, they ate all this stuff up. So the Hall Mills murder, where you have, you know, a prominent clergyman in an affair with a working class woman from his choir, and he had married into this wealthy family. It had all the elements that tabloid paper newspapers, as we know them today, you know, would have been super interested in. And also, you know, the whole thrust of the tabloid newspapers, you know, now, but also then when they were born, was that these were photo-driven newspapers. They were called picture papers. So this was the first time that there were smaller, compact newspapers that were easier to read. They were more friendly to, you know, a less literate class of news consumers, and they were filled with photographs. So, you know, that's what really distinguished them. And the tabloid newspapers, that there's three of them that existed by the time of the trial, which was in 1926, you know, they splashed, you know, huge images of these characters from this story on the front page throughout the paper. And that was something that was unique and new. And I think, you know, this was one of the first real, you know, as they call them, crimes of the centuries, that got that sort of treatment in the press.
Yeah. And I kept thinking that, you know, you mentioned during this time, I mean, this was the time, like, you know, in Hollywood, you had the scandal of Freddie Arbuckle going yep. on, right?
That was the year before the Hall Mills. That was 1921, and Hall Mills happened 1922, but that was a perfect example of the sort of sensational crime stories that people were just like drawn to like magnets in this period.
And they still are today.
And still today, for sure.
You know, I mean, I was thinking that, well, let's talk, I don't want to go too far forward too fast, because the one newspaper that I think did more harm, I don't know if they did harm or more, they covered it more readily, was like the New York Mirror. Was that the newspaper?
Yeah. The Daily Mirror, that, you know, the first tabloid, just to back up for a second, was the New York Daily News. And that was the first tabloid in America. And that was the only tabloid that existed during the first phase of this crime in 1922. You know, you hinted that there was a few years before it actually ended up going to trial. And what happened in those intervening 4 years was that, you know, tabloids began to sprout around the country, and particularly in New York, where the Daily News had become not just the most successful newspaper in the city, but in the whole country, essentially. That really, you know, put some of the other publishers on notice, and William Randolph Hearst in particular, who
that was my next name,
who we know from the famous Yellow Press of the turn of the century, and he was this newspaper kingpin. He realized that he needed to start his own tabloid to compete with the news, and that was when he created the New York Daily Mirror. And it was the Daily Mirror that, you know, as you say, maybe it was they did more harm than good. I mean, what they did was basically intervene in this matter and bring the case back to life and force it in front of the authorities and get the case reopened. It was really all of their doing that the case came back in the first place.
Right. And this gripped America. And now I'm going to go jump ahead a few decades here, because I mean, I kept thinking the O.J. Simpson trial on TV. If TV had existed back then, I could see this trial being on TV.
Yeah, this was the OJ of its day. You know, this was like that level of interest.
Yeah, and you know, I was wondering, how did you come upon this case? Because I'll be honest, I hadn't heard of it before.
So I had not heard of it either, because you know it was so famous in its day, but it's sort of largely been forgotten to history. And I went to Rutgers as an undergraduate, going back more than 20 years now. So I lived for 4 years in New Brunswick, New Jersey, where this took place. And there's a lot of, you know, still a lot of local lore about the case, and locals are very familiar with it. And Rutgers houses one of the major archives devoted to this case, but I'd never heard of it. I never encountered it. And it wasn't until, you know, years and years later in 2018, when I was casting about for book ideas, I was catching up actually with a professor from my graduate school days at the Columbia Journalism School. And she's a historian, journalism historian named Andy Tucker. And we were talking about, you know, different crimes of old, newspaper sensations of old. And she was mentioning a bunch, and she mentioned the Hall Mills case. I thought that had a nice ring to it. And then she mentioned it happened in New Brunswick. So I immediately was interested, because I, you know, I lived there. I knew the area so well. And, you know, as we were also talking, about the creation of the tabloid press at the time, and just how wacky and outrageous these tabloid newspapers of the 1920s were, even by today's standards. I mean, they did crazier things than, you know, your mainstream tabloids even today would probably venture to do, you know. So that was the genesis of the project, but I was starting pretty much from scratch in terms of my own knowledge of this. But, you know, once I started digging in, you know, there were just so many fascinating characters and so much rich material that I got obsessed pretty quickly.
You got to tell me about the Pig Woman.
So the Pig Woman, there's a woman named Jane Gibson. She lived on, you know, this sort of adjacent farm to the abandoned farm where the bodies were found, and where it was determined that indeed the murders had been committed in 1922, the first era of this case. She kind of emerges out of nowhere at this point, where the police, the prosecution, and the detectives who were investigating this are kind of at a loss. They have gone down a few wrong turns. There's immense public pressure, immense political pressure. you know, immense pressure from the newspapers to make some progress in this case, which has become this complete national spectacle, you know, and brought a fair amount of ill repute on New Jersey and this area of New Jersey. And, you know, it wasn't a good look that they weren't getting anywhere. So there's a lot of pressure. This woman named Jaden Gibson emerges sort of out of almost as if out of nowhere and comes forward with some vital information. She claims that she was a witness to the murders. The story that she tells is pretty wild. In a nutshell, it involved this late night ride on her mule named Jenny. She'd been, you know, supposedly chasing some thief she thought was stealing her corn, and she, you know, is riding around on the abandoned Lover's Lane adjacent to this farm, and eventually hears a commotion and you know, creeps closer and, you know, hears gunshots. Here's a woman cry out, "Oh, Henry." Henry is the name of one of Francis Hall's brothers, Francis Hall being the wife of the philandering reverend. Yeah. And then there's, you know, she tells this story in different iterations in the coming days and weeks once it gets out into the newspapers. But, you know, the kind of the main details of it kind of remain consistent. She's out on a late night mule ride, witnesses this murder. That's the gist. But she was this really eccentric, theatrical character, this sort of pioneer woman who lived on this ramshackle farm, but had a successful business, you know, selling corn and raising hogs or whatever. But really had this strange backstory. The story she told about her life didn't match up to what reporters actually found about her. So her credibility was pretty suspect from the beginning. Sometimes she was very hostile to the press. You know, one time some photographer showed up on her property and she, you know, appeared with a gun and told them not to come closer, and she fired some shots at them and they go hightailing it. But other times she also courted the attention and she talked a lot to the press and, you know, by all accounts was probably getting paid by the newspapers for them to be able to take pictures of her and put them on, especially with the case of Daily News. You'd see her on the front page. One of the main detective in the case posed on the front page of the Daily News next to her mule. That was the famous mule from the mule ride. So she became this instant celebrity, to the point where even real celebrities were paying attention to her. There was an interview that F. Scott Fitzgerald gave to a newspaper at the time where he name checked the pig woman and her Jenny mule. So, I mean, it just gives you a sense of the level of interest in this case, you know, across the American populace. And, you know, Jane Gibson really becomes probably the star character in this whole saga, because she becomes the prosecution's key witness.
And I mean, yes, I mean, and like you said, the newspapers, either they loved her or they hated her. And I mean, they would make fun of her, like, you know, she wasn't well educated or anything like that. But you know, like you said, she was like the media darling to some of these guys.
She was media, and it was interesting because they did sort of look down on her. But there was also evidence. You know, I think they recognized that she was keen, she was sharp, she was smart. She knew what she was doing, and I think she knew how to work the press the same way they were getting what they needed out of her. I think she was getting to some extent what she needed out of them, and she wasn't. You know, she wasn't by any means like a stupid woman. And she, you know, she had good records. She, you know, kept a pretty detailed accounts of her farm business and all that. But there is definitely an element of, I mean, you know, just the fact that, you know, her nickname became the pig woman, that's definitely a pejorative, yeah, sort of characterization. But I think there was an extent to, there was some degree where they did, you know, recognize that, you know, she wasn't just some complete dummy or something, you know, and she got some very sympathetic coverage too. So, you know, however you slice it, she really kind of, I think, is one of the people that really super juiced this case.
See, and this case, excuse me, this case really laid the groundwork for all the rest of the cases of true crime stories that came after them. I'm thinking, it was Leopold and Lowell. Yeah, they were after
Yeah, they're around the same. I don't, there's a new book out too about Leopold and Loeb right now. but it was, you know, that was another 1920s. You know, I grapple with this a little bit in the book because this wasn't the first time that newspapers, you know, were going wild with these sort of crime stories that the whole public gets drawn into. I mean, in the Victorian America, you had the penny press and you had sensational newspaper crimes, as we talked about with the Hearst and Pulitzer papers. That was a thing. But my argument would be that with the emergence of the new medium of the tabloids and the new emphasis on celebrity culture and also this focus on, you know, like big personalities, I think that's what really was new here. And I think that that's where I see a through line to today, where we think of true crime, you know, I guess you can call, you know, what newspapers are writing true crime, but I think of it more as, you know, it's something that for, you know, for better or worse, it's something that people view as entertainment. And I think that, you know, whether that's today, it would be the murder podcasts that people binge or Netflix, you know, documentary series, that's entertainment, you know. And I think that the tabloid press, their whole purpose was to entertain, to give the news to people in an entertaining way. The Daily Mirror's slow, you know, their slogan was 90% entertainment, 10% information. So this medium lent itself to explicitly being a form of entertainment. And I think that's kind of the through line to the true crime of today. And I think that's where it's the through line to, you know, court TV and, you know, reality TV and all these things. It starts with tabloid culture in the 1920s.
And now with the internet, like court cam or whatever that's called.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Joe Pompeo is the author and the book is Blood and Ink, the scandalous jazz age double murder that hooked America on true crime. Joe, again, thank you for doing this tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
Blood and Ink, the Scandalous Jazz Age Double Murder That Hooked America on True Crime, is written by Joe Pompeo and published by William Morrow. Until next time, I'm Jim Juno, and this has been Light, Camera, Author.